Actually, I thought I'd be doing it tonight. I'm doing it now. I have to do it later. So I'm going to go deliver it to him. I'm just going to make some general statement because I don't. You asked a very general question and I have no idea what you want. Which doesn't matter. I just, something triggers and I start going. Okay. But then you're going to have to, you know, punch in your particular request, like MapQuest.
Yeah.
Okay, so you can just ask for directions in general.
Right, a general map.
And I give you directions in general, I could do that. I can give you a general direction in life. But then at a certain point, you have to tell me where you want to go. So, does anyone know?
Security.
Yeah, it's really secure. Very selfish kind of thing. Be religious. Right, so what? Right, Chase, in Seattle. We were there for a wedding a few years ago. Racheli's? I think it was Racheli's. So they asked him to give a class. Because you have to have some, you know, some purpose in going down. Purpose. So that was one of the questions about purpose. So he kind of said that, I don't want to disappoint, you know, but if you understand it correctly, there is no purpose. But you're not supposed to say that. Because everybody assumes that there's a purpose. What does it mean there's no purpose? You can't say that, what's the purpose? You exist to help others. That doesn't, that's what most people will say. But, you know, why, what's the purpose of his, so what's the person, what's the purpose of his being helped, of his life? What's his purpose? Or, if that's the case, I just saw another interesting, I think it was from one of his essays, that people who say that if you believe that the purpose is to help others, so then you have to, it's part of your desire that people should always be in need, because once people are no longer in need, then you really can't help them, and then you have no purpose. Something along those lines.
But there's always going to be people in need.
Well, but theoretically, you know. Well, let's say you had it. Look at it philosophically. It's rooted in a negative. So that's, you know. But anyways, you understand? Because why? I'm just sort of going off on that idea now because I want to make it clear. Yeah, well, she didn't call you.
She did call me.
Oh my God. That's how you got so engrossed in in the conversation. All right, we didn't forget you, Khalida.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, she's cute on the phone. No.
But the purpose is to serve Hashem. That's the purpose.
Well, yeah. But how do you serve Hashem? Since Hashem doesn't need your service. That isn't it crazy?
Because
what did Hashem do?
Why are we here?
Okay, well, you can't answer that question of why we are here.
But there's got to be a reason.
No, you see, all of basically, it's impossible for a person to answer the question of why. That's what the Rambam goes through in the Mor Nevuchim. That it's an impossibility. You can't. It's the wrong question. Why did God create the world? When we do that, we're projecting onto God our own way of functioning. You could ask, why did you take the car and drive into the city? Because you did it for a reason. You had a need. And there's a why. But you can't ask the question in terms of why. Why does God do something? We don't. That's because it's all part of God. Doesn't act like that. Like God has something extraneous to Himself. That God has a need, and that whole thing is absurd. So there is no purpose in the sense that we are accustomed to understanding it. What does it mean to serve Hashem? When you say a thing like that, you're implying that God needs someone to serve Him. How can that be? We can't. How can we serve Hashem? How can you, a being, the ultimate existence who has no needs? He's the ultimate, and He's the creator. He brings us into existence. Our existence is contingent. That is, we wouldn't have existence were it not for the creator. So we, the created, are going to satisfy a need in the creator. The whole thing is an absurdity. So you can't look at it that way. And how can we serve Hashem? What does that mean? What can we do? We say that in the tefillos. I'm not making this up. We say that in the tefillos, by Ne'ilah, that What can we do for Hashem? Well, v'im tatzdik, and if you're righteous, matifalo, what do you do for him? He's the ultimate existence. We're feeble, so to speak. We wouldn't exist had he not brought us into existence. So we can't do anything for Hashem. Now, but we use that terminology. We use that terminology because man has to have certain examples, certain metaphors to push him in a direction. But you can't take these things too literally. But I think people do. The idea of the Eved Hashem is that he accepts that Hashem is the guide, that to follow the guidelines as opposed to making up his own, as opposed to following your own whims. But to follow the idea of serving Hashem, what do you get out of it? This is what the Ramban says, that all of the mitzvos are for you. That's because Hashem knows the way you were designed. It's a very complex being. Man is a very, very complex being. And left to their own devices, most people will pursue a way of life that's not in line with their nature or with their good, so they'll miss the mark, so to speak. It'll be a wasted life. A life that's not lived in accordance with the design is as though you didn't live at all. It's as though you didn't fulfill your nature. You have a certain nature, and that nature has to be fulfilled. If you design something to fly, if you design the plane to fly, but the plane can also go on the ground for takeoff. All right, but that was the design. Then you left, and people discovered it. And people discovered it, and they never knew the idea that this thing flies. But they did know that it can go on the ground. So imagine that you discovered this group of people that had this plane that could fly, but they didn't know that. They didn't bother to study. They were too lazy. Because in order to discover that, it was contained in certain books, and they'd have to make an effort, and all that, and they just followed their natural mode. They got in there and it starts, and they used it all their life as a bus. And they thought they were really, wow, that instead of a horse and buggy, they now had this thing to move them, and they would go 100 miles or so, whatever, how fast they could go. And then you came to these people and told them, what are you, crazy? This is the greatest tool. If you know how to use this properly, you think your movie is doing so. You go from Brooklyn to Queens, and it only takes you a day. You could go to Israel. You could go to Los Angeles, and they'd say you're nuts. But basically, what would you say? That it was a wasted thing. That it never achieved its objective. There was an objective. In other words, the designer, when he designed it for an objective, and they took something which is just a minor thing. It's just a means, actually. An accident, because it has to taxi. That's the way it goes. It has to taxi and then take off. It's not one of those planes that lifts off directly. They took that and they made that into the entire essence of it, never realizing that flight. So therefore, the whole thing failed. I think that's a very good analogy for human existence. That is the sense in which we differentiate between one who serves Hashem. The one who serves Hashem listens and goes through and studies and learns how to fly, because it doesn't come naturally. It's another thing is that that's more instinctive, to be able to go on the ground, to taxi with the airplane and use it as a bus. That's easier. That didn't take much skill or talent and was much more in line with their emotional way of looking at things, because it has the tires. Okay, so it's just a new form of energy powering it. Wow. But the idea that it can fly and take off and all of that is very abstract, and you have to really use your mind and you have to study. And you have to discipline yourself and train yourself. So that they never went into. They just rejected it because it looked ridiculous to them. That, I think, is a pretty interesting analogy as to how people work. That if so, they never attain real existence. They never attain real existence in the sense that this airplane never achieved its existence because it was designed for a purpose and it didn't exist as an airplane, did it? It existed as a glorified horse and buggy or wagon or bus, whatever you want to call it. The Airbus. If you want to use the word purpose, then your purpose is to become the airplane. That would be the same thing. A person that lives a emotionalistic, instinctualistic based life and never activates the intellectual component and becomes a thinking being, a thinking animal, to put it that way. That is an individual who lives their life with all of the challenges of the life as we find ourselves in this world, and we can't even ask why. We don't want the wisdom of God or the will of God, which is one and the same thing, decreed. that we should, that there should be a being such as this. Not that it benefits God in any way. Whether we choose to become human, let's put it that way, to fulfill the design or not, that's up to us. Free, that's in our power because of the phenomenon of free will. That God left it to us to make that decision. That's free will. To live this kind of existence or that kind of existence. But the other, that's the choice between life and death. Because if a person doesn't choose the correct type of existence, which is appropriate to his nature, so then he doesn't achieve existence. So basically, his life is really like death. It's not real. It's not considered true life. That's what Chazal say, that Rishayim b'chayayim kruyim mesim. That the wicked, even when they're alive, are called dead. Because it's not real human existence. That's the idea of that's your purpose. You want to call it your purpose, call it your purpose, whatever you want to call it. It means to say that's your design, and all you can do, which is good for you, is to be selfish. That's all you can do. And either you live a life which is life, you choose life, or you choose non-life. And then you live your days as an animal without activating the specific part that differentiates you, the divine element, the Tzelem Elokim. The general pathway of perfection is in that area, the area of man, which is removed from the instinctual, that is pertaining to the soul, the ability to discover truth, the abstract. That's the more a person appreciates the Chachmas Hashem in the universe. So the more that becomes what's real for him and he pursues that, the more perfected he becomes. That's the direction. That's the direction. I mean, obviously there's a quantitative element. Some people partake of it more, some people partake of it less. But that's the Torah. The Torah then is the divine revelation that God did not just leave you, God created you with a specific design. But God did not just leave mankind to its own devices, because to achieve that path, to discover that path, and to set up a way of life which is based upon that is difficult. Let's put it that's difficult that we see even after the Torah is given. Even after the Torah is given, it's very difficult for people, because people take the Torah and treat it like a religion. They kind of treat it like they take the airplane and make it into a bus. They don't really see what the real benefit of Torah is, and they make it into an ordinary religion. And thus, one must study the mitzvot, the Tamei HaMitzvot. To perform the Torah without studying the Tamei HaMitzvot is to deprive yourself of all the benefits. I mean, it's minimal. Which is really a shame when you see that when Jews take the mitzvot and they twist it around and they make it into all kinds of magical tools and mystical things and all kinds of projections based on these pseudo-Kabbalistic-y kind of notions. And what they're doing, aside from the fact that it's meaningless, they are taking something which is the greatest source of light and enlightenment. That's the real tragedy. The Torah is really a book of light and enlightenment that can guide you in all areas, and you're rejecting that, and instead you're making it into a book of who knows what, things that make no sense to anyone. I'm talking about this very popular Kabbalistic stuff that nobody, you know, doesn't have any, I don't know how it became like the rage today. It's kind of like a rage. Everybody's into Kabbalah. I mean, I don't mean just the Madonna and that thing. I'm saying a lot of Orthodox, you know, Jews,
yes,
it's all Kabbalistically
Jews.
Speaking. Kabbalistically speaking. What does that mean, Kabbalistically speaking? Is that another way of speaking? To me, are you telling me an idea, a thought? It's got to make some sense. All right, sometimes it's clearer, some things are clearer, sometimes less clear, but I see what you're getting at. But I have no, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. It's a whole new way of thinking that nobody knows what you're talking about. That this creates unities and the cosmos, that there was a big explosion and now there's unities. When you do a mitzvah, every mitzvah creates sparks and you unleash sparks. Well, what are you talking about? It's gibberish. It's using words that have no, you can't attach a meaning to it. So how can people work with a system like that? Back to our subject, the Tamei HaMitzvot is extremely important. mitzvah, we should institute a program in Tamei HaMitzvos to go through the mitzvos. First of all, it's important to just know your mitzvos.
I like that idea.
And just in a perfunctory way, a general way, we can, as we study, doesn't mean that we're going to uncover the reasons. The Rambam talks about that in the Mora. And he says that there are certain... Well, we know for a fact that some mitzvos, only Moshe Rabbeinu knew the reason, like the Paraduma, but he went through, generally speaking, he discovered the reasons, he maintains, for virtually all of the mitzvos, if not every one. And in some cases, he differentiates between the basic mitzvah itself, then you have all the particulars in the mitzvah. That the particulars also have a reason. There's no randomness in the Torah. And there too, he says, in certain cases he discovered the reasons for the mitzvah itself as well as the particulars. In some cases he didn't discover a reason for all the particulars, but whatever the case may be, it's a worthwhile study. This week we take up Parshas Lech Lecha, which we've studied in the past. And we've raised this question in the past, but it's being raised again. And that is to say that it sort of begins not at the beginning, because it's really the story of Avram. That's a beginning. It's a whole new phase in the history of mankind, that Hashem has a very special relationship with this individual. We don't find that in the past. He's not the first person that Hashem has communicated with. He's not the first prophet that you find in Gan Eden, Adam HaRishon. More specifically, if anyone of the characters pre-Avraham who has a relationship, which we would call a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, would seem to be Noach, would seem to be. Because Hashem, Noach found favor. If you find favor, then interesting. Even though it says Hashem lo yusa panim, that God doesn't show faces. God doesn't recognize people. But Noach found favor. So the basic idea... Well, that was the Gemara we did on Shabbos. Just briefly, the Gemara mentions that, because we're doing the subject of Birkas HaMazon, and women in Birkas HaMazon, that's the Shabbos afternoon Gemara for women topic. I can't hear. The Gemara asked a question. It said that there's a contradiction, because it says that, Asher lo yisa hu akela, gadol, Asher lo yisa panim, v'likach shochad, that God doesn't recognize faces, that is to say that God doesn't have favorites, and God doesn't take a bribe. It's an interesting idea. Lo yikach shochad, he doesn't take a bribe. Which means that just about everybody else does. Of course, the question is, how could you possibly bribe God? But the Sforno has a very interesting answer, which we've done. What's the answer to that? A bribe presupposes that I have something that could sway you. And I'll sway you by giving you the bribe. But of course God doesn't take a bribe. That's not the point. The point is that we can't bribe God. The Sforno says with mitzvos. The Sforno says only when a person sinned. When a person has sinned, then you can't bribe. That's in the context, because that's when you want to bribe. You want to bribe the judge to get away with the sin. Then he says you can't bribe Hashem by doing mitzvos. What you could do, and you don't have to, what you could do is to do tshuva. That's his interpretation. That the only thing that works when a person sins is tshuva. However, what has come up, the idea that when a person is in a difficult situation and you want divine assistance, so what about that? Hashem, if you only get me out of this, I'll do such and such. That is a good thing that one can do. But be careful, because then it becomes binding. You can't play a game like that. And then at the moment of stress, you say, I'll do such and such. It should be done intelligently, but with that idea, with the merit, the schus, that, yeah, because that's part of tefillah and ishtadlus. That's part of the perfecting oneself. It's not a game. It's not a magical game. I'm going to do this, you do that. God, we said it at the outset, God doesn't need your service. You need your service. But as you elevate yourself to a higher level, so then you become more deserving in the sight of Hashem. That's the idea. So that if a person says that if you heal me from this, I'm going to do more deeds of charity, and specifically, I'll work for this particular chesed thing, or I'll do more learning, and so forth. I'll try to repair a relationship that I broke, and so forth. So then that's appropriate. I mean, what if you don't? So then you're in a bind. What if it doesn't have, you don't get what you want? But now what about the things you said you were going to do? Well, then you're not bound in that same way. You're bound in the way you would have been bound had you never said it in the first place. It shouldn't be understood in a magical way. There's no gimmick like that. There's no guarantee that it's going to work because we don't know the will of Hashem. We don't know the Hashgacha. We don't know these things. But we do engage in certain things, first of all, because they elevate us. And that itself is a value. That's the ultimate value. Secondly, it may help us. There is such a thing, of course, we believe that God hears prayer and God responds. But we can't guarantee the response. That's something I think everybody has to recognize. So that in that sense, it increases your merit. It increases merit. You always want to increase merit because it has to do with merit. That's all I could say on that subject. First part, though, was lo yisapanim, that God doesn't curry favor with anyone. God doesn't show favor to anyone. So the Gemara asked the question, but you do show favor to Israel, because it says yis Hashem panav elecha v'yasim lecha shalom. That's the Birkas Kohanim, that God will show face to you, favoritism, whatever it is. It's the exact thing that the Pasuk is saying he doesn't do. Lo yisapanim. Here it says yis Hashem panav elecha. So the Gemara has the Gemara has it as a story that the Malachi Asharis asked Hashem this contradiction. So the Gemara answer is, but how shall I not? How shall I not show favor to them? I said that they eat for Savata. You only have to bench when there's Sfias. But they came along and they said, I'd kibetza, that for a kazayas, basically for a kazayas. So I shouldn't show favor to them? That's a very fascinating story. Well, there's another question, though. It hasn't answered the question. At the end of the day, is there a contradiction or isn't there a contradiction? I brought it in for a different reason, because the Gemara says that women are chayiv in Birkas HaMazon. But it's a suffix whether it's the Araisa or the Rabbanon. The psak is that women are chayiv, but it's a suffix whether it's the Araisa or the Rabbanon. See, my question was that it should be either or. Either they're chayiv, the Araisa, or their Pater. Well, you don't find a situation like that. You don't find that the Rabbanon didn't come along and were machayev women in mitzvahs where they're Pater. So it should be either or. So I wanted to say that the Chachamim came along and created a new institution, that the Torah only obligated, this is not like a fence around the law, the Torah only obligated for Sviya. The Chachamim, because of the idea of Birkas HaMazon, Chum came along and created a new institution of Birkas HaMazon mid the Rabbanon for any achila, for a kazayas. So they included women. That's the they included women in their institution. They didn't just, it wasn't an extension of the Dioraisa, because the Nachai mid the Oraisa. But I wanted to say that the answer is. So what's the answer, though? I mean, so is there a contradiction? How could there be a contradiction? Well, the way the story goes, that God answered them and says, well, shall I not show favor to them? Yeah, but that was the question. The question wasn't, why do you show favor to them? The question was, the Pasuk says that you don't show favor. And now we're learning that you do. So what God seems to be saying, but I mean, superficially read, it seems to be that God's conceding that there's a contradiction, but what do you want from me? I have to show favor to them. I mean, in human terms, that's how we would read the story. But that doesn't work. At the end of the day, is there a contradiction or isn't there a contradiction? Excellent. The way the story should be taken is that the Pasuk is saying that God doesn't show favor. God doesn't recognize faces. Faces means that there are certain people that are special. We took up this ideal issue in conjunction with the philosophy of Kayan. People have this notion that they're special, that God likes them, or they're entitled. A person has, it's a very, very, it's the kind of thing you don't brag about, you don't talk about, but it's personal. You really feel that God does it because God knows me. God knows my goodness. The world, meh. The world may not always. Sometimes the world doesn't appreciate you, but Hashem appreciates me. Each person feels they have a certain special nature, a certain quality, they're fine. And that at a certain point that when you appeal to Hashem, it's that, because I'm good, because I really care, because of how I feel. That kind of thing. We want to be liked. We want Hashem to like us. Now, is that true? Is there such a thing that God doesn't like that person? The ones that, that kind of thing. But God, we sometimes think of others that God likes that person. There's something about that person God likes. Is that true? Is there any truth to that? Does God like people? Well, the pasuk over here is saying that that God doesn't work that way, so to speak, quote unquote. We work that way. We're affected by persona. Let's face it. Sometimes to our detriment. Sometimes, you find someone very likable and all of that because they're cute, whatever it is, and they're not really what they're cracked up to be, but we're affected by it. And people that know how to get to you, get you to like them. They can evoke that within you. That chain, there's a certain chain they have. So people, we're in the human realm, that does work. That's a factor. There are certain people you just don't like. And you can't put your finger on it. Don't ask me to explain. I just don't like them. Of course, we don't admit to that. And there's certain people you just like. And they can get away with a heck of a lot. You'll see. You don't treat everybody the same. Even parents with children don't treat them all the same. Because you like this one, and the other one, gets you annoyed. It's a big myth that parents like all their children equally. That's what it means. Ashela Yisapana means that God doesn't curry favor to any individuals. Because of their personality, whatever, those kinds of things that they think are important. But then they ask, so what about Israel? So the question was, Israel, maybe Israel, you like Israel, you like that nation. So Hashem said, no, the answer was, it's not them, it's their Maisim Tovim. That's the only thing I recognize. It's not because they're special. To the contrary, we see the Jews get treated more and more harshly when they sin. But that's what it means, that when God, so to speak, shows favor, it's related to the Maisim Tovim. And that's the example. The case is that they could have just relied on V'achalta V'savata, but they saw the point, they saw the idea, and they extended it to Kezias. Now we're dealing with the question in Lech Lecha, in that a whole new phase begins here in terms of Hashem's relationship to the world, and specifically through a certain individual, through Avraham. You see the closeness that Avraham enjoys, a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That is, he tells him to leave the land, abandon his family, etc., to the land that I will show you, and so on. Then he comes, and then the famine, he goes down to Egypt, and then his wife is taken away, and God smites a whole new thing, and God's with him, protecting him. He smites Paro, and Paro, not only does he release her, but he gives tremendous gifts. Well, the gifts he gave before. Avimelech gives the gifts afterwards. But, and then the whole incident, continuously, you see the tremendous extent of the relationship between Hashem and Avram. But it doesn't start off by telling you who he was or why. That question always bothered me. Shouldn't it tell you? That is, we know the story. What made him unique was that he was raised as an idol worshiper. The whole world was steeped in idolatry. And this individual came along who discovered a whole new pathway, a whole new kind of a religion, the religion of the mind, to discover the God of reality by the use of his mind and to completely reject all forms of idolatry. That itself, the renunciation, the utter and complete renunciation of idolatry, and a completely different way of relating to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, like we've just by living this intelligent existence and conquering his emotions in all areas. So that's Avraham Avinu. But we're not told that. That's part is omitted, and you go to the results. Now, how do we know who Avraham was? How do we know all of this? How do we know? Well, basically, we read the Rambam. The Rambam in Laws of Idolatry, everyone should read that. Chapter 1 is extremely important. And where did the Rambam get it from? From the Gemara, it was brought down. This is part of our Masorah. Of course, it's the Rambam's interpretation of the Masorah with the smashing of the idols. He brings that down, the smashing of the idols. It wasn't just the discovery. There's another component to it. Equally important. You can't have one without the other. Was that after he made this discovery, he didn't keep it to himself. And he demonstrates the true compassion of trying to save the world, so to speak. He was the true. That's the true of an individual that really is capable of, so to speak, saving the world. I mean, not by himself, nobody could do that. But he has the goods. He has the cure for the illness of mankind, the falsehood of mankind. True religion. True religion comes into being. We are his descendants. A question that was the topic for the afternoon. Are we following the religion of Avram? The Rambam has his interpretation of it, but it's based upon what was passed down, who Avram Avinu was. And once you know that, so now we understand that this person was chosen by Hashem to be the leader of a movement to spread. That's the whole idea, really, is that why is he leaving home? What's the point? Basically, okay, it has to do with Eretz Yisrael, but it's not just Eretz Yisrael. I mean, Eretz Yisrael is part of this whole idea. Eretz Yisrael is part of the idea of Avraham Avinu that he will be the means by which mankind will learn the truth that they were created for. So he's going to become a great person. He's going to become known. He has to become known. And people will come to him, and he needs a platform. He'll have a platform. And Eretz Yisrael. Eventually, there'll be a nation. The only way for this to survive, for this body of ideas to survive, this unique way to survive, is through the nation, the Torah, of course, and the nation. And the whole system that's set up to perpetuate these ideas. That's basically what it's about. So now you understand. Now, if you had this context, you really can't read Lech Lecha and understand what's going on over here. Without that, the two go together. The two go together. Now, once you should really begin by studying chapter 1 of Idolatry, Laws of Idolatry. That should be in the Chumash, let's assume. Ah, now I know who this person is. Now I know why God's talking to him. Now I know what he did. Ah, now you come along and you are Lech Lecha, and so on and so forth. But now, person can read the story. I don't know how many people have read chapter 1 of Laws of Idolatry. How many people have any idea why Lech Lecha is happening? This is the style of the Torah. Bear in mind that the Torah was not written as a book of abstract ideas. But it's intended to be the book of this is the book of the people, and the people read it. And if you really want to get the benefit of the Torah, you have to study it. Now, the derech is, what you see is really the results. The Torah is concerned in showing you, it's another important point too, that all of the great people that are portrayed in the Torah, they're not portrayed in terms of their intellectual achievements. That's not the portrayal. Although they were all great minds, great thinkers, Avraham Avinu, but he was also a man of action. The deeds, in terms of the nation, in terms of the people, you have to portray them in terms of the perfection that it leads to, because the people don't appreciate abstract thought. So you're not going to find the Torah portraying anybody, David HaMelech, no one, even Moshe Rabbeinu, is never portrayed as lost in thought. The characters of the Torah are always portrayed in terms of their perfections. That's the first step. It's also very, very important. For many reasons, it's very, very important. That this is the derech. This is the correct way. And it manifests itself in correct way of living and dealing with virtually every situation that the person can encounter. By using this method, this derech, the person will act correctly. That's the real perfection. so that one reads about this individual, and you may have a certain sense, okay, so you started with a certain sense that he was great, obviously, and God knew him and all of that, but then the objective of the Torah, of the written, is to stimulate thought. In all of the encounters of Yosef and his brothers, it's very, very difficult. The story is a fascinating story, but it's even misleading. It's always a challenging story. The way the Torah is written, it's intended to grab you, to get your interest, and when you start to read it, you'll see it doesn't make sense in a simplistic way. Why is this pasuk over there? Why? It's up to you. It's up to you if you want to have it as a simple Bible story, Bible stories for children, and then even when you're 50 and 60, it's still Bible stories for children. Or do you want to have access into the inner chamber, so to speak? That's not going to present it for you that way. It's not going to present. You should have a certain mystery. Who is this Avram? Who is it? Why? When you have that mystery and you start to ask questions, then you're ready to proceed to a higher level. If not, he was an idol, he broke the idols, whatever. That's simplistic. That's it. Without any further. Then he will be, a simple religious, Abraham and Sarah, the Imahos, whatever the case may be. The Torah does not reveal everything that way. It's important. It retains mystery. It keeps certain things mysterious. As I said, if you read the story of Yosef and the brothers, superficially, it's very, very difficult to comprehend what kind of people were they that would kill their brother over seemingly trivial things. I always ask that question. But if you think about it, I defy anyone. These are the Shiftei Kar. These are the leaders of Israel, the 12 tribes. They're all on a very, very high level. And they were prepared to mistreat their brother. And look at the pain they inflict on their father. For what? Because he made a mistake with the coach. All right, so he showed favoritism. But give me a break, because he had a few dreams, which they thought were crazy dreams. So because of that, you kill someone. That does not make sense, doesn't add up. I don't know how many people ask the question that way. You have to know when not to bring something up. There are certain issues that you have to be prepared for a defense. Sometimes the people ask certain kinds of questions, but you have to know how to answer. But I'm not going to bring it up if they're not going to ask the question. If you bring it up, you bring up a question, okay, a challenging question. Hopefully you've worked something out, you have a good answer. So the answer will satisfy. But then there's a case where if somebody asks me, I can defend it. It's a defensive position. But I'm not going to bring it up. If somebody challenged me, they thought this doesn't make, and I was able to defend it, that's a win in that context. But me bringing it up, and giving them the question, and then I have an answer, which is at best a defense, that there's no win. That doesn't make sense. That's what I'm saying over here. That's part of it. I mean, there's a number of factors. We don't understand all of the wisdom, why God chose to write the book this way, and how much was contained in the story, and how much is not. But that seems to be a pattern. So that the true appreciation of the core, the inner greatness of Avraham, that's a more advanced level. However, the appreciation level in terms of the Torah, because of his deeds, you see, he followed Hashem, El Arz HaShareka, he went to the land, he didn't complain. The Torah is bringing out deeds of greatness that reflect his underlying philosophy. But the underlying philosophy itself, that's not going to be discussed on the pages of the Torah. That you're going to have to probe for. Yeah.